WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Senator Ron Johnson pulled no punches during an interview on Fox News about the elite's role in the chaos we're experiencing. Argentina is on the verge of making a right-wing turn, and the Biden crime machine is as determined to hide its crimes as it was to commit them. These stories are coming up, but first, on Thursday, Tucker Carlson published an interview with former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund. Tucker brought him on to discuss what really happened on January 6th. This wasn't the first time he'd interviewed the former police chief. Tucker first interviewed him when he was still with Fox News for an episode that never aired. Stephen Sund was in charge of the police protecting the Capitol on January 6th. In the interview, he said he never received any intelligence from the FBI or any other agency warning of potential violence on that day. He found out afterward that the FBI did indeed have intelligence to this effect, but it didn't share it with him. Sund said he tried for 71 minutes to get approval from the National Guard to help his police officers when they were under attack. Even then, he said, the guard didn't arrive at the Capitol until after the violence had ended. Sund also said he wasn't told about the plainclothes federal agents that were in the crowd on January 6th. He thought this was concerning since the Capitol Police would want to avoid a blue-on-blue clash. But whether the plainclothes agents may have instigated the violence, he didn't think that was the case. Listen.
You know, nowhere do I want to imply or indicate that I feel that agents instigated this or in any way like that. I'm never saying that. I haven't said that. And a lot of these agencies came to my defense on January 6th, FBI, yes. Secret Service, stuff like that. So we just want to make sure that's clear. But
Tucker also pointed out that there were people in the crowd who were goading others to break the law, but who weren't arrested. He specifically asked about Ray Epps.
Here you have a guy on camera repeatedly saying, we're going to the Capitol.
We need to go into the Capitol. Into the Capitol.
And he's not in jail when people who didn't go into the Capitol are in jail? What do you make of that?
Again, that's something I actually address in the book. It's funny, there's a lot in here. So my concern with that, and I look at it from a chief of police point of view, is you have somebody that's down, and I believe he's right near the old executive office building on the 5th, the day before January 6th, talking to a group of people, talking about, we have to get into the building. And then the next day to see him at what's called the Pennsylvania Avenue Gate, it's one of the two fence lines I had down at the West Front, and he's there, and he clearly sees the banner, the metal crowd control barriers that are up with the signs saying restricted, you know, so he knows that's a restricted area. And he's up there, and you see him lean in, and he whispers in somebody's ear, and he covers his mouth in such a way so you can't read his lips or anything, whispers in somebody's ear, and that person moments later is attacking my officers. That's suspicious as hell to me. It raised a lot of concerns.
What is that?
You know, and what's interesting is I believe...
And that's verified. The person into whose ear he whispered...
Yeah, I think if you watch the video, you see that, and yeah, that person immediately go and start pulling on the gate and start, you know, fighting with the officers. And what's interesting is when... I believe he went on 60 Minutes. And on 60 Minutes, what he said was he went up to the officer and he told that officer, these officers are on our side. Don't hurt these officers. I believe that was pretty much not verbatim. But don't hurt these officers. They're on our side. Don't hurt these officers. Well, if that's the case, why would you cover your mouth and not yell it to everybody? Because it didn't seem like that protester was the only one that was possibly going to be hurting the officers. You had a whole bunch of people next to him. Why wouldn't he tell it to the whole group?
I don't know. I know that Epps is being encouraged by partisan Democrats to sue people who raise these questions, but they're fair questions, and I'm going to raise them anyway. How, given that tape, could the January 6th committee defend Ray Epps, which they did? Doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I'm having trouble answering that one. I don't know.
Join me to discuss today's stories is Executive Senior Editor of the New American Magazine, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
Good. So in this interview, this Capitol Police chief, he says there's a lot of curious things that happen, a lot of strange things that happen, but he's also very cautious, as we've discussed. What is your take on this interview and all the things related to it?
Well, I haven't watched the whole interview, but, you know, it just underscores why we have always, as an organization, us, the JBS, have been wary of public demonstrations. So,
oh, good point.
I mean, you know, we're protecting the right to peacefully redress our grievances before our elected representatives and so forth and so on. But these kinds of boisterous public demonstrations involved, you know, carrying signs and so forth, they so easily can be misdirected and run off the rails. I mean, this is part of the this is part of the recipe, you know, the rules for revolutionaries recipe going back to the French Revolution, at least, you know, where it was widely remarked by various of the instigators of the early social unrest that produced ultimately the revolution and the topple of the French monarchy, that, you know, for a few sous you can go out there and buy a good riot. It's not that hard. You go out there and you pay people, you know, the equivalent of a couple dollars or something like that, and say, you know, just go be rowdy, you know, rock a few police cars, smash a window here and there. We promise you there won't be any consequences, but we need people to get things going. And this happens, you know, obviously it was the recipe behind the coordinated BLM riots, the Antifa rioting and this kind of thing. And unfortunately, you know, there were a lot of people in the crowd on January 6th, I think, who came to simply express their displeasure peacefully.
Right.
That got caught up in it. And then, of course, you know, who may not have themselves committed any acts of violence or instigated same, but, you know, they're in jail anyway.
Yeah.
And this points out the difficulty of this sort of thing.
Yes. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not that, I mean, like you said, wary is the word there. We're not necessarily against rallies. I've been to Trump rallies, but you could get a whole lot more done by not doing that, right? By using your energies and your resources to get involved.
Absolutely. Well, and beyond the fact, as anyone who's ever been to a large sporting event, like a college football game or something like that, knows, people individually may be intelligent, but in large groups, they're stupid. I mean, there's a whole sub.
There's a lot of studies to
there's
that.
There's a whole, you know, crowd psychology has been around since the mid 1800s when Macaulay and people like this started observing that people behave differently in large groups. In part because of the dilution of moral responsibility. It's one thing, you know, if I'm mad at you, you know, to say, hey, I don't like you and so forth, but I know that I run a risk that we're going to have a fight or something like that if it's one-on-one. But if I'm in a big crowd and everybody else is shouting, well, the likelihood that I'll have any consequences for bad behavior are correspondingly diminished. So, you know, you go to a football game and one minute everybody's all excited that your team's just scored a touchdown and things are going on. The next minute, the refs make a bad call and the opposing team, and then they start throwing things at the refs. And I've been at, you know, when I was an undergraduate at Penn State, I went to many Penn State games. I've seen goalposts torn down by inebriated crowds and, you know, the officials pelted with snowballs with stones in them in this kind of late season and this kind of thing. And so, you know, you translate that into a political setting, which is, you know, infinitely more volatile.
The stakes are higher.
The stakes are higher. And it's no surprise that, you know, mob violence, rioting, rowdy demonstrating, occupying public buildings, this is the stock and trade of the radical left for decades. I mean, way back in the 60s, that's what they were doing. They were occupying college buildings and, you know, and in some cases, you know, roughing up security personnel and all this sort of thing. So,
good point. And so we encourage viewers and listeners, if you want to know how to really get involved in something, go to jbs.org. We have action projects. We have several other ways that you can get involved and make a difference that'll last. We're going to move on to our next story now. Last Friday afternoon, when the public attention was shifting to the weekend, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced that he was appointing U.S. Attorney David Weiss as special counsel to investigate Hunter Biden. David Weiss is the same guy who slow-walked the previous Hunter Biden investigation. He refused to investigate the serious charges of foreign influence peddling or anything else that might implicate the big guy. He also tried to cut a sweetheart deal on behalf of the president's son to make sure all that is hidden stays hidden and Hunter continues to be shielded from severe consequences. That's the David Weiss the Biden Department of Injustice appointed. As special prosecutor, Weiss can hamstring congressional investigations of the Biden crime family's foreign bribery schemes. This is almost certainly why the Biden DOJ has pulled this cynical stunt. The DOJ can now refuse to turn over evidence, and it can block House investigators from getting further incriminating bank records, emails, and the like. Not only is this move another clear sign of despotism, but according to Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Weiss's appointment is illegal. She pointed this out in a lengthy Twitter post Friday afternoon. She said, not only is David Weiss unqualified to conduct this investigation, his appointment by Garland is illegal and violates federal statute. The qualifications clearly state the special counsel shall be selected from outside the United States government. David Weiss is currently the U.S. attorney for Delaware. Joe Biden's attorney general is breaking the law right in our face. MTG also said in the same post, Republicans, including the House Oversight Committee, have revealed more information on the crimes of Joe Biden and his son in just 7 short months than the corrupt DOJ, especially David Weiss, have in years. That's exactly why this plot to obfuscate, distract, and ultimately cover up the Biden crime family's corrupt business model is unfolding before our eyes. Weiss has ignored mountains of evidence. The entire prosecution of Hunter Biden by Weiss has been a cover-up. However, Congressman James Comer is assuring to the public that this latest attempt to stifle Congress won't work.
Well, this is another example of the Department of Justice stonewalling and obstructing our investigation. I've been complaining about this for months, but yet we continue to deliver evidence that shows of massive Biden wrongdoing and more evidence that shows Joe was right front and center in this from day one. What this does today, it protects David Weiss from coming in front of the committee, which is fine. This is an investigation about Joe Biden. I don't think we need any more evidence to show that the Department of Justice is trying to obstruct our investigation. I think Merrick Garland made that argument for us today. We're going to continue to follow the money. We're going to continue to interview witnesses that we know have firsthand knowledge of what exactly the Bidens were doing to receive the millions and millions of dollars from bad actors in bad countries around the world and what role Joe played in this scheme. And that's what's important to every American, what role Joe played in this scheme, because we believe that we have a president of the United States that's compromised because of the millions and millions of dollars his family's taken in. We're not going to stop. This is just another day in the office for us leading this investigation of Biden corruption. They have obstructed every step of the way. They've intimidated our witnesses. Look, when Devin Archer was set to come in on Monday morning, the DOJ sent him a letter Saturday and a letter again Sunday. That's never happened before. Never has the Department of Justice sent a letter on a weekend, and they send two on two separate days for the sole purpose of intimidating him. They have intimidated every one of our witnesses. The Biden legal team, Abby Lowell and company, they have more than crossed the line of witness intimidation. You saw what the legal team did in the Delaware court, trying to intimidate another person to take something off the website. There's example after example of obstruction. But, Laura, we're going to continue to move forward with this investigation.
Okay, Steve, so how does this work? You have one side saying we're going to continue to investigate. But now, isn't the investigation supposed to move to Weiss and company?
Well, of course, it will be a tool to try to block, to say from now on, as they've already been saying, but now perhaps with greater urgency, no, we're not going to show you this latest document that you're requesting. We're not going to allow this witness to testify because that's our bailiwick now. We're conducting the investigation. The obvious counter move now, of course, is for the House to, and I'm sure they're going to do it now. There's little doubt now that they're going to move in the direction of an official impeachment inquiry, because that can't be blocked
based on the evidence that's already.
Yeah, I mean, based on the evidence they already have, as Comer, the point Comer makes. And although there are a lot of people that the House can still seek to talk to, one creative alternative would be to conduct an interview to arrange a sort of a secret interview with Gayle Luft, wherever he's hiding overseas, you know, online or something like that, to get his testimony, which of course will be decried by the Department of Justice because he's a wanted fugitive. Well, yes, because of course they went after him and turned him into a fugitive by indicting him on more spurious charges. So it is absolutely contemptible and very third world. What's going on? It's getting more and more third world by the day. It looks exactly like what goes on in, say, Malaysia or some African country, where the first thing you do when you get into office is you jail the opposition. That's just the way we run things around here. And unfortunately, the United States is descending to that same level.
Right. Well, maybe this is the turbulence that we need before the calm.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Thanks, Steve. So, hey, folks. Have you gotten your tickets to the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference this September? If not, you should, because the ticket window is about to close. This year, we'll be gathering in Des Moines, Iowa, and we'll be going over effective strategies you can use to restore our nation. We'll bring plenty of materials you can take back home with you as well. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet other patriots working to restore our wonderful nation. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, and his discussion topic will be The Death of Science, Medical Freedom in an Era of Lies. James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, he'll also be speaking, and on Friday we're going to do dinner and watch his movie. Former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King will join us as well, as will renowned physicist and election expert Dr. Douglas Frank. The New American's Alex Newman, he'll be there as well, and he'll be talking about how climate change is used to scare and control people. And that's just a small sample of everything that will be happening over those 2 days. You can learn more about and get your conference tickets at jbs.org. Or if you prefer to call, you can do that, 1-800-527-8721. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or by calling 1-800-527-8721. And stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. On Friday, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin joined Fox's Maria Bartiromo to talk about a number of topics, almost all of which prompted him to discuss who and what is really behind the chaos, corruption, and destruction that we're experiencing. Bartiromo discussed the about-face of the FDA, which now admits that it's okay to take ivermectin for COVID. Here's what Johnson had to say about that.
We need the truth to be exposed. We need more Americans to listen to the truth, to be exposed to the truth, to pull their heads out of the sand, quite honestly, open up their eyes and understand what has happened in this country. We are going down a very dangerous path, but it's a path that is being laid out and planned by an elite group of people that want to take total control over our lives. And that's what they're doing bit by bit. They do it by increasing massive government spending, increase in the size of government, takeover of the WHO. These amendments that are coming up that are going to be voted on in 2024 on the WHO are frightening, and they really risk taking away all of our sovereignty. People have to awaken to the dangers of the moment.
Bartiromo continued on the topic of COVID and COVID shots and how social media companies work with government officials from the CDC, FBI, and CIA to amplify lies and suppress truth, as she called it. Why couldn't the American people know about medical alternatives and the side effects of the shots, she asked. Here's what Johnson had to say.
This was all pre-planned by an elite group of people. That's what I'm talking about. Event 201 that occurred in late 2019, prior to the rest of us knowing about this pandemic. Again, yeah. This is very concerning in terms of what has happened, what is happening, what continues to be planned for our loss of freedom. Again, it needs to be exposed, but unfortunately, there are very few people, even in Congress, that are willing to take a look at this. They all push the vaccine. They don't want to, be made aware of the fact that the vaccines might have caused injuries, might have caused death. So many people just simply don't want to admit they were wrong, and they're going to do everything they can to make sure that they're not proven wrong. We're up against a very powerful group of people here, Maria.
Back in July, I interviewed Senator Johnson, and one of the questions I asked him was about how he got to this phase of understanding, and here's what he said.
I think I probably always suspected it, but as you come into office and you just see what happens, and when I do investigations, I see the power of these federal agencies, and you see the video montages of everybody that's gone to the World Economic Forum coming back and saying, we're going to build back better.
Yeah.
It's like, man, that just doesn't...
Just parrots all in line,
right? It's amazing what video evidence what it can provide in terms of information now.
Thank goodness for it.
But, you know, there's a couple good books. You know, I've gotten to know Bobby Kennedy pretty well because we fought the same fight.
Did you read his book?
So he's recommended a couple books to me. You know, and the first two are written by very liberal authors, so I had to kind of get by that reading these books. But very well sourced and researched. The first one is JFK and the Unspeakable. And I'm just telling you listeners, read it. Okay? Won't say much more about that. Read it. The next one would be The Devil's Chessboard.
David Talbot.
Talking about Alan Dulles' CIA. When you finish with those, go ahead and read The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah.
And
now you know. Now you're red-pilled, huh?
Yeah. Then that kind of completes your eye opening, combined with 3 years of COVID.
Yeah.
As I've witnessed the censoring, as I've seen the truth being, you know, not only just buried but destroyed.
But the collaboration.
With the collaboration, the trusted news network or whatever, it is frightening.
Among the three books he credited for his understanding, one of them was Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. That book was first published in 1994 by the John Birch Society's book publishing division. The authors, G. Edward Griffin, a former JBS coordinator and current ally. The JBS is the parent company of the New American Magazine. JBS has created a mountain of materials, books, magazine, pamphlets, documentaries, and more, explaining what really is happening. Sunday was primary election day in Argentina to determine who would qualify for the presidential elections in October. Firebrand free market economist and member of Argentine Congress, Javier Milei, who's being portrayed as a right-wing extremist by the establishment media, was lagging in the polls days before the election. It looked like, in the end, the usual suspects in the Argentine political establishment would push Milei aside. For months, Milei, who's very popular with Argentina's youth, was conducting Trump-esque high-energy rallies and public meet-and-greets across the country. Here's Milei getting the rock star treatment in the province of San Juan recently.
Lleno de gente, todo explotado, todos esperando que sea el próximo presidente de Argentina. ¡Vamos, papá! Así están recibiendo a Milei en San Juan.
On Sunday, Milei's campaigning and principal defense of liberty paid off bigly. He finished first in the elections by a wide margin, and he's looking very much like Argentina's next president. Libertarian and trained economist of the so-called Austrian school, Milei owns a pit bull named Murray after Austrian economist Murray Rothbard. If elected, he intends to take a scythe to Argentina's bureaucracy and to dollarize the Argentine peso. With inflation now running far above 100% annually and getting worse by the day, the economy is near total collapse, and Argentines may finally be ready to try something new: free market economics and greater personal freedom. Milei is an articulate enemy of socialism and communism, and he's probably the best-known advocate for freedom in the entire Spanish-speaking world. Here he is, riling up the crowd.
Ahora vamos a invitar a subir al escenario a los gobernadores presentes.
Okay, Steve, what's he saying?
He's saying, Viva la libertad, carajo, which is a mildly profane. That's his campaign slogan.
Yeah.
And it means something like, long live liberty, damn it, or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very Argentine expression.
Yes.
And along with that, and after that clip continues, the crowd breaks out into this chant that they have, which is, La casta tiene miedo, la casta tiene miedo, which means, La casta literally means the caste, as in like a social caste. But in Argentina, it's sort of the term that equivalent to the establishment of the deep state. And it means the deep state is afraid. The deep state is afraid. So that's their other campaign slogan. So it's very hopeful, very hopeful stuff. And in addition to, his bona fides as an economist, Milei is very strongly pro-life. He is very strongly pro-gun. Argentina is one of the few countries in the world outside the United States which continues to have a pretty robust gun culture.
Okay,
and he does. There are a lot of big gun stores in Argentina. But when I was there last October, everybody was talking about this guy, particularly people under the age of 30. And not just in the Buenos Aires province. I was in some pretty remote parts of the country, and people that didn't even strike me as being very educated were going on about this guy and how great he was and how they had become they now believed in the free market and so forth and so on. And this from a country that has literally for decades, probably 100 years, has labored under various forms of socialism. They call it Peronism or now Kirchnerism after the late President Kirchner and then his wife, mm-hmm. who was president for many years and is a good friend of Hillary Clinton, by the way. And the thing is, he basically, if you could create a sort of genetic chimera of Rush Limbaugh, Donald Trump, and Ron Paul, that's what this guy is. Yeah, he's a fearless debater. He's very articulate. Again, I don't know how much English
he
speaks.
He's a former talk show host, isn't he?
He is. He started out in radio. He has a degree in economics. Mm-hmm. And he has a pit bull named Murray after Murray Rothbard, another one named Milton after Milton Friedman. So he's hardcore free market economist. He self-identifies as a libertarian. In fact, he's published a book called El Camino del Libertario, which is the path of the libertarian, in effect. So he could become the first ever libertarian and Austrian economist to be a head of state, which I think would have Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and Murray Rothbard's turning over in their graves if they knew.
This is really, really good news. And even though what happened in Brazil and other neighboring states, there seems to be a movement in South America, would you say, as well as
Definitely. Certain
parts of America toward conservatism.
Yeah, we'll talk about it more in some other episode, but there's a larger movement in Latin America.
Absolutely.
Towards the right, as we would say.
Absolutely. Great, great news. Thank you, Steve. All right, folks, and that's it for our news segment. We will be right back with more New American TV.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Next up is Beyond the Cover. In today's episode, Gary Benoit interviews Steve Bonta about his cover story, Is It Too Late for America?, published in the latest print edition of the New American Magazine. Is it too late? Social unrest, government corruption, economic and financial instability, nuclear weapons, and moral depravity cause many to question if America can still be saved. But Steve Bonta, like the New American and its John Birch Society parent company, says it's not too late, and he explains why. You don't want to miss this.
This is Beyond the Cover with your host, Gary Benoit, and today we have with us Steve Bonta, who is the executive senior editor for the New American Magazine, and also the author of the cover story in our August 28th issue of the magazine entitled, Is It Too Late for America? So, Steve, a good starting point, is it too late?
Okay, well, spoiler alert, it's not too late. And not only is it not too late, I don't realistically see America coming to an end. Okay. Now, one of the things that people always do is that they confuse a country with a civilization. Okay. So when Rome fell, and the parallels always being drawn between America and Rome, Rome was the totality of civilization at the time. I mean, if you went beyond Rome to the Sassanid Persian Empire, you're dealing with a different civilization altogether. So Rome was more or less synonymous with classical civilization at the time, in a way that America actually isn't. I mean, we are the pivotal country, the central country, but we're far from the only country in the broader realm that we call Western civilization. So in my article, I kind of examine this question not just as a, you know, sort of a diagnosis of America's woes per se, although the title focuses on America, but the article, we look at the broader history of the West. And by the West, I mean this civilization that came together in the early part of the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, whatever, that's sort of a hybrid of a hybridization of Judeo-Christian culture and faith with the Greco-Roman classical culture that had gone before. And so these two kind of coalesced, particularly under the banner of the Christian religion, and became what we now refer to as Western civilization. And from very modest beginnings in an obscure Roman state of Judea, it has overspread much of the world to the extent that today, even those parts of the world like, say, China and India and sub-Saharan Africa, most of sub-Saharan Africa, that would not be deemed part of Western civilization per se, we still see a lot of the influence of Western civilization. In nothing else, perhaps, the inventions that came out of the West are used there. The use of Western languages like English and French in particular that have become so cosmopolitan all attest to the incredible and enduring influence of Western civilization. Okay, now that said, looking at today's circumstances, as we note in the article, as most of our listeners are well aware, we are indeed in very perilous circumstances
right
now. And not just because of the woke culture that's destroying our culture and the, you know, the political crisis that ongoing with the, you know, the Biden corruption and the Trump, all of that stuff, you know, is maybe unexampled in American history. I don't know. We've had some pretty acute domestic crises in the past.
Civil War, for one thing.
Sure, the Civil War and others that people are less familiar with, like the electoral crisis of 1876 that came after the Civil War and nearly tore the country apart again. You know, so we have had these epical crises from time to time, but not only domestically, but also we now have three or four hostile powers out there that have the ability to obliterate American cities with nuclear weapons and things like this: China, North Korea, Russia. I mean, these are perils that are new in some sense, at least in terms of degree, but in American history. But if you look at the longer span of Western history, you find challenges this great and greater that would have destroyed any other civilization. Challenges like the Mongol invasion or the rise of the Ottoman Turks. Those are military challenges. Challenges like the Black Death and the ensuing roughly three centuries of plague that consumed, most people don't realize the Black Death was only the beginning. The plague continued to consume Europe about every 10 years. It never quite attained that initial pandemic status in the mid-14th century when it first arrived in the scene. But the Great Plague of London in the time of Isaac Newton, which killed, vast numbers of people, in urban England desolate at the time. That was in the 1600s. And there are many, 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 many other episodes. And yet in this incredibly toxic milieu, somehow Western civilization not only survived, but flourished. And we could multiply examples like this, which I try to do in the article, of how, this thing called Western civilization has survived onslaught after onslaught after onslaught, both of natural origin, like a plague or something like that, and political origins, from within as well as from without. And so, seen from that larger perspective, there's nothing really terribly unique about the time that we live in. We're in another period of crisis, but we've overcome it before. And the question, to my mind, is why? Why has Western civilization proven so uniquely resilient? Because it is a very, very ancient civilization now. It's been around for two millennia, in effect. Okay, so and it has survived so far every attempt to eradicate it.
Well, I certainly want to ask you why, Steve. But before we get to that, I do want to make the observation that one thing that really impressed me regarding the cover story article that you wrote is just what you said: the resilience, the fact that at various points in history. It would have seemed, if you looked at it based on logic and based on the information available at that moment, surely Western civilization could not have survived. Surely Christianity could not have survived. And of course, Christianity and Western civilization are very intertwined, and yet they did time and again. So I can imagine somebody living back in those early centuries, living back many centuries ago or a millennium ago, imagining this is probably the end of the world, that our civilization is just going to completely collapse. And many people must have thought that. And, of course, whoever thought that during those time periods obviously was proven wrong and proven wrong time and again.
Well, okay, so let's look at the Black Death as a specific example. That is the nearest thing we have in all of recorded human history to an extinction-level event. It killed as many as one-half of all people in Europe. And in some places like northern Italy, in particular the city of Florence, the mortality rate was much higher than that. In fact, in Florence, it's believed up to 80% of the entire city were wiped out in that first onset of the Black Death. Okay, so how do you survive something like this? Well, it just so happens that there were certain unique souls, Boccaccio and Petrarch in particular, who were already famous writers in the period before the Black Death, the late Middle Ages. They survived the plague and went on to be the people who initiated the movement that we now call the Renaissance. And, you know, I think there are two ways of looking at this that I think are, you know, perhaps fruitful explanations. One is the little slogan on the back of our dollar bill that says "Anuit coeptis." Most people ignore that. It's right over the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the New World Order. People make a lot about that. But what does "Anuit coeptis" means? It means he has approved our undertaking. He being God.
Yes.
And I think the evidence for anyone with eyes to see is that, you know, Western civilization has been uniquely blessed. It has served God's purposes from the beginning. It is approved by him. And this is the reason that it has, against all odds, survived. I think there's something else that goes along with that. And that is, a long time ago, there was a man named Oswald Spengler who wrote this marvelous two-volume book called The Decline of the West. And it actually has nothing to do with decline, actually. He has this very interesting idea. It's about how civilizations coalesce around a sort of a fundamental symbol. And he said for the West, that symbol is basically infinite space. That's the symbol that we have. And if you understand that, this is the reason that we Westerners, we men of the West, have always striven, you know, to reach beyond our grasp, have always and ever been reaching for the infinite. The idea of progress, for example, that we all take for granted today, really arose in the High Middle Ages. You know, for all of the brilliance of the Greco-Roman, you know, classical minds, with the exception maybe of Seneca, you really don't see any of this idea of progress. It's more, you know, it was a world in which fate and destiny played a much higher role than this idea of, you know, the idea of individuality. And many other things that are part of the warp and woof of Western culture that we take for granted, we've talked about this before, I think, on this show, are not necessarily found in the other great civilizations and cultures outside the West. And that is one of the things that makes us less susceptible, because that is why I think a soul like a Petrarch or a Boccaccio could say, after such an awful, awful event as was the Black Death, to say, well, let's try this again. And the thing they tried again became the Renaissance. Or someone like Isaac Newton, who was as a relatively unremarked upon young university graduate, was driven away from Cambridge University by the Black Death and had to spend 3 years back at his home in Wollstonecraft, this tiny English village where he grew up. And in those 3 years, he didn't do a whole lot except invent calculus, invent the laws of optics, you know, work out the physics of gravitation, just that. Okay, while people were dying, of course, by the hundreds of thousands in the streets of London and other big cities in England. This is the way the West works, because, you know, we Westerners have this indefatigability in that we see, we understand our infinite potential as sons and daughters of God. And I believe that is what is going to triumph in the end. And as I say in the article, we don't yet know, you know, the exact path we're going to take. No. I mean, we're
but
clearly...
But we do know the end result. Yeah, we know that God is not going to be dethroned.
No, he's not. But and, I mean, and we're, it's very clear that we're in a state of decline right now. But that does not mean that the decline is going to last forever. I don't know how far we're going to have to fall before things turn around. But as has been, has proven to be the case so many times in the past in our Western history, because of what it means to be civilized in the Western sense of the word, I am absolutely convinced that we are going to turn this thing around. It may be a work of some generations yet. Okay, it may take a while. It may not happen next year, next electoral cycle. In fact, I pretty much guarantee it won't. But it will happen because it has happened before, again and again. And the intent of my article was to show people that the survival of the West, or what we may give it a different name ultimately, but this marvelous civilization that we've created, the best aspects,
right, it's
anyway,
not going away,
is inevitable.
Right. And it was inevitable, I would say, even if you go back to Imperial Rome, where Christians were being lit up on lampposts to light the streets of Rome, or when they were being fed to the lions, and it was an infant religion at the time, and yet it survived and flourished despite everything that Rome did to stamp it out. And if we look at today's times, is it really as bad as what the early Christians endured in Rome?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. But I know this. If there's a catchword or a motto for Western civilization, it should be this. Three words. Dei soli gloria. They can be arranged in different ways because it's Latin, right?
Right.
But it means to God alone the glory. And most of the great figures of Western civilization, including the aforementioned Newton and many others, scientific and philosophic and other creative minds of that age, you know, up through the 1700s and the 1800s, that was their primary motivation, that everything they did was concentrated to the greatness and glory of God. Leibniz says near the end of near the end of the Critique of Pure Reason, says that, you know, one of the three fundamental tasks of any philosopher should be, you know, understanding the nature of God. That's what it's all about. Now, most modern-day philosophers would probably disagree with that, but in Kant's time, and certainly in Leibniz's time as well, you know, that was taken for granted, and that's the real secret sauce
right.
for the success of Western civilization.
And who's to say that's not going to happen? Because even though things may be running downhill, so to speak, in terms of belief in God in this country today, there certainly, in the past, in this country, have been religious revivals.
There have been, and I mean, you know, the glory of God is eternal. It only remains for us to rediscover that fact. That's really all that's needed. Now, obviously, there are details involved. That's what we do here at the John Birch Society and the New American Magazine, the education and everything else. But that foundational principle of the West is not going to go anywhere.
Right. Now, fast forwarding to America today, one thing I've noticed is that you have a lot more people who are waking up to the fact that we really have a serious problem, that the survival of the United States as a free and independent nation is being threatened. And a lot of people are waking up because they see the threats that are much more visible now than they have been in the recent past. Consider, for example, the lockdowns with COVID. Consider other threats associated with COVID, or of course, you pointed out that the Chinese threat is very significant. But what would you have to say to people today who are waking up, and right after they wake up are deciding, oh, it must be too late, even though not that long ago they didn't realize there was a problem in the first place?
Yeah, well, there are three things that have to happen. First, as you say, is the dawning awareness, the waking up. Okay, then there needs to be the education, the understanding. I mean, obviously, awareness that something is wrong is not enough because people will draw many different conclusions.
Right.
Number three, and most crucially, is once the understanding, or maybe concomitant with the attainment of understanding, comes the action, which is encapsulated by this wonderful word virtue, an old Latin word, right?
Right.
That civic virtue and education must be paired, and then the rest, as they say, is academic. I mean, you know,
people have to be involved in the freedom movement, and they have to be informed, or they might do things that will make things worse, even though they're trying to make things better.
Yes. Unless people misunderstand, the freedom movement is synonymous with the movement for saving civilization. That's what it's all about. Western civilization is the most perfect form of, with all of its imperfections, is by far and away the most perfect form of civilization ever created, and can probably yet be improved upon, no doubt. But that's what it's really about. It's saving freedom means saving civilization as we know it.
Well put. Thank you very much, Steve. And of course, we encourage everybody to read Steve's article. His cover story in the August 28th issue of the New American Magazine, Is It Too Late for America?
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
Well, we need just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
To complete today's show, Gary Benoit interviews Steve Bonta in another installment of their ongoing series on fundamental principles. Today's principle: in our federal system of government, the states are superior in authority to the national government. Let's listen.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Benoit, and today with me is Steve Bonta, who is the executive senior editor for the New American Magazine. And of course, Steve, once again, we are talking about a fundamental principle. And today's principle is the fact that the states are superior to the national government and our federal system. So, Steve, welcome once again to A Discussion of Principles.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here, Gary. So, by superior, we mean superior in authority.
Yes.
And the clue to that is actually contained in the word federal, which comes from the Latin word foedus, F-O-E-D-U-S, which means a covenant, or a compact in Latin. So the question becomes, well, what a covenant or compact between whom and whom? And the answer is between the states and this creature. The states are the creators, and the creature or created is this federal government, which originally was more of a confederal government, a confederation under the Articles of Confederation. It was understood at that period of time, which spanned the American Revolution and then several years thereafter under this first constitution, that the Congress, which represented, there was no executive branch as such or anything like that. There was just a Congress. First it was called Continental Congress,
right.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so this became the kernel or origin mm-hmm. of the American government. But it was well understood by experience that this Congress was wholly the creation of the 13 original colonies that became the 13 original states, and that when the war was over, America as it existed was in this rather fragile Confederate state. That has to do with a Confederacy in the Civil War. That's something else. But this loose confederation whereby the states had almost all the power, including powers control over their borders, powers to impose tariffs for things that crossed from, from, say, Virginia to Pennsylvania or something like that.
Right.
The power to appoint ambassadors and to treat with foreign countries. So it was really a confused state of affairs.
Right. I mean, in essence, every state was was its own nation.
Right. I mean, they were mm-hmm. bound together. The Congress, as then constituted, didn't really even have any power to tax, to raise revenue. Depended completely on the sufferance of the state. So under those conditions, it was very clear that the states were the master, and Congress, which was the only thing that we had as a national government, was strictly subordinate thereto. Now, what emerged from the Constitution, of course, was a national government with considerably greater power. And so, powers, for example, to wage war, powers to, in certain cases, adjudicate between the states and even tell the states that they can't do this. So the Constitution certainly contains powers that are denied to the states. So anyone ill acquainted with American history and with the notion of what federalism truly is, would be forgiven in assuming that, well, you know, the government of the United States works like other governments. You have a national government, and they're supreme, and then all these regional governments or state governments that are basically subordinate to or answerable to the authorities
they're
in Washington, D.C.
basically regional units or administrative units.
Precisely,
precisely.
And that's what you have in France, for example.
Right.
But not in the
United States.
Right. I mean, so we have two types of republics. You learn this in your political science. So one is called a unitary republic, and that's what France is, because France is divided into departments which do not have any sovereign powers of their own, right? They're just, And then the other is what's called a federal republic, which is what we are. And in a federal republic, there's this compact between the national or federal government and the state governments, with the added assumption that the states have most of the power.
Right.
And the power that they don't have is power that they have voluntarily ceded to the national government or delegated to the national government. Through the Constitution.
Right.
And not the other way around. They weren't created by the federal government.
Right. Of course, that phrase "federal republic" is certainly used, but another phrase that is used in the Federalist Papers is a compound republic. And I'd just like the quote, Steve, from the Federalist Number 51, and this is written by James Madison, Federalist Number 51, who was known as the father of the Constitution. But he said, in the compound republic of America, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, and then the portion allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate departments. Hence, a double security arises to the rights of the people. The different governments will control each other at the same time that each will be controlled by itself. So, I mean, that's proof positive. That's just one illustration of the fact that what you're saying is absolutely correct, Steve, that the states are not administrative units or regional units of the national government, that each state itself is a republic. And the combination of these various republics, the various states, plus the national government, which is also a republic, that's where that phrase federal republic or compound republic comes from. But it provides a double security for the liberties of the people, as Madison said.
Well, another quote from Madison that is very epigrammatic about the same issue. He said at one point, and I paraphrase but only slightly, he said, you know, that under the Constitution, the powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined.
I have it right here.
Okay, why don't you read that?
Okay, and this is in the Federalist Number 45. And it says, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite.
Right. So, I mean, that should make clear what is meant by federalism. It's a simple concept. But again, as with so much of the way the American government is constructed, the way the Constitution is worded, it is quite revolutionary with respect with what had gone before in all of world history. So it has been said, for example, that the Founding Fathers, great as they were actually not extraordinary innovators. Most of what they did had been tried somewhere else, sometimes by someone else in history. Okay, the one thing that everyone agrees was a true innovation by the founders was the invention of federalism, and that came about by accident. That was not something that was contemplated in the original Virginia plan that Madison drew up in the weeks leading up to the Constitutional Convention. It was something that came about as a result of a compromise that allowed the Constitution to pass. And after the fact, I mean, some of it was there, but the idea, of how to partition to make sure the smaller states and the larger states had more or less equal representation, with the Senate and all this type of thing, the great compromise that was forged that ultimately took the shape of federalism. It's only after the fact, certainly by the time the Federalist Papers were written, that people like Madison said, this is a really good idea, this idea of dividing power between the states and the national government. But it wasn't necessarily something that occurred to them during the time that they were crafting the Constitution. Now, another thing that we should look at quickly, of course, which makes this clear to anyone other than a Biden, perhaps, how the government is intended to work. This is the 10th Amendment, the Constitution. And it says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, and the United States means the United States the federal government, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So that's another way of saying, in effect, what you just stated, you know, that the default assumption, if a power in the Constitution is not enumerated, i.e. mentioned specifically as being delegated to either the executive, legislative, or judicial branch of the federal government created by the Constitution, then it is the default assumption is that it resides either with the states or, if not with the states, then perhaps with the people. In other words, it's a power that never is even given to government at all. Okay, and we could go through many, many Sure. examples of this. The assumption now, and that's the essence of constitutional law. The essence of constitutional law is whatever is not permitted explicitly is prohibited. And people find that very hard to grasp but haven't thought about that because the normal way that law works, criminal law, is precisely mm-hmm. the opposite. Namely, whatever is not prohibited is understood to be permitted. So if, right. so if government wants to make something illegal, they have to pass a law saying, you know, you can't do this. But with constitutional law, the reverse effect obtains for reasons we don't have really time to go into. But the bottom line is that for reasons of economy of space, you can't possibly, you know, list all the things that are prohibited government to do.
Right.
All you can do is say, well, government can do this, 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 and this. And then you don't have to list that and those. If they're omitted, that's enough to say they can't do
right.
it.
And, of course, the Tenth Amendment makes that
and
absolutely
And the Tenth Amendment,
explicit.
Just in case there's any doubt, although it's mentioned multiple times, this principle mm-hmm. of enumerated powers, which is what we're referring to here, the Tenth Amendment makes it crystal clear. And yet it is the most consistently violated, trivialized, ignored, and misunderstood principle of everything that we could talk about touching our Constitution and our federal government.
I know, but at the same time, we still have the Constitution. Violated though it may be, and the solution is simply to get back to the Constitution, and of course that's one reason why we're having these episodes on basic principles. So thank you very much, Steve, and I look forward to talking to you once again next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, viewers and listeners, for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We will see you tomorrow.